Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. If, like millions of Americans, you work in an office, this next conversation is about you, about what you do, and how productively you do it. Here's one thing we know about office design. It's often the result of fads. Cubicles, no cubicles, open designed, closed meeting rooms, rotating desk assignments, standing desks, treadmill desks, even no desks.
Anthony, I have a treadmill. Actually, I have a standing desk on my desk right now. So we have been through many of those here at WBUR.
Indeed we have.
But our next guests say there is no such thing as a new office design. We just take old ideas, put them in a kaleidoscope, and turn. And it turns out that the newest thinking about workspace uses measurable data to figure out what actually works best.
And if there's one key word in all this, it's collision. When workers have opportunities to cross paths or collide with each other during the day, productivity, even creativity, can go up.
The most innovative workspaces take into account lots of factors, from the very mundane, like where people sit and where the office coffee machine is located, to the more complicated, like whom they talk to during the day and how they use technology.
So listeners, we want to hear from you on this. What kind of workspace works best for you? A corner cubicle, a private office, or a noisy common room or cafeteria? What about co-working spaces? We're going to talk about those as well. And what kind of workspace doesn't work? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And joining us now are two folks who've done a lot of thinking about this subject. Ben Weber is the president and CEO of Sociometric Solutions. He's also a visiting scientist at the MIT Media Lab. And Ben Weber, good to meet you, and thanks for coming in.
Great to be here.
And Jennifer Magnolfi, she's an R&D consultant who focuses on high-tech work environments. She joins us as well from New York. Jennifer, good to have you.
Good to be here. Thanks.
And Jennifer and Ben co-authored a recent piece in the Harvard Business Review, which included the provocative line on its cover, "Why We Hate Our Offices and How to Build a Workspace We Can Love." And you can go to radioboston.org and find a link to that piece. But Ben and Jennifer, let me start. There have been a lot of fads, as we've mentioned, in office design without much discussion why any of these designs work or don't work. And you write about a sort of data-based approach to figuring out what works. So Ben, I'll start with you. How did you gather data to measure the impact of office design?
Well, if you think about what we do every day and what we carry around with us every day, actually, we carry a number of data collection tools with us. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have our company ID badge, we have our cell phone, and those are filled with a number of sensors in them. And, you know, the little ID card you use to tap into doors actually has a little radio in it, which if I put little radio readers in the ceiling, it could figure out where you are, besides being a little creepy. That doesn't actually tell you how people are collaborating, how they work with each other. And what we've done is create a next generation company ID badge that can measure those things. There's a microphone to measure who talks to who, how you talk to people. It doesn't record what you say, but we're combining that with motion data from an accelerometer, with Bluetooth to do location.
Right.
And we're combining that data with sales data, job satisfaction data, so that we can actually figure out what makes people productive and happy.
So just to be clear, people that you've sort of studied are actually wearing little badges, right?
That's right.
Kind of collect all of this data, and so you sort of know where they're moving, who they're interacting with. And Jennifer, what does that tell us? What are you actually measuring with these badges?
Well, I think what Ben's work and certainly the technology that he's developed points to is to a broader shift in the world of work that we have seen occurring over the last certainly 10 years. And I think that primary shift has been a shift to digital space. Most work functions today happen in digital space. We used to enter a building that we call the office to get into the mindset of work and work. Now we just have to access our work-related data on our mobile devices wherever we happen to be. So this type of working and interacting and collaborating in digital space has really shaped our communication patterns, our assumptions, our expectations about work and performance. So visibility into those communication patterns becomes important. Workers today who are used to work in this way and digitally savvy workers certainly are, don't realize that this way of communicating informs how we collaborate, how we construct new knowledge, and how we make decisions, which are all basic work functions across any work discipline. So this has design and also management implications, of course, for the office.
Sure. Now, Ben, you write a lot about this notion of creating collisions between employees, and you say that face-to-face interactions are by far the most important activity in an office. So just listening to what Jennifer was talking about, it seems like working in this digital space becomes, I mean, I want to talk to you first of all about the importance of these collisions, but doesn't working in the digital space in a way work against these collisions that we need to have?
Well, I think they work together in a very interesting way.
Yeah.
And if we think about the importance of collisions, imagine you're trying to come up with a new idea. One way you could do that is you could sit at your desk and you could talk to the people around you and hopefully come up with something interesting. Probably what's going to be a lot more effective is you bumping into somebody from another department, from even another company, who's working on something completely different. And there had been some, you know, anecdotes around the importance of that. And what we're able to do now is put some hard numbers on exactly how valuable are those collisions between people in different social groups. But on top of that, what's interesting when you think about the digital lives we live today is that we don't really have the technology to actually collaborate and create those collisions in the digital world. You look at a company like Google, which, interestingly enough, if there's one company that could make, you know, remote work work, it would be Google.
Yeah.
And yet they have tens of thousands of their employees at a big campus because they intuitively believe that these collisions are important. And so while ironically more and more of the work that we're doing is digital, it's also getting more and more complicated. And face-to-face interaction is critical for understanding those complex things.
Yeah. So does that mean, Jennifer, I mean, because one of the wonderful things about the digital age is it provides all kinds of flexibility and flexible work environments, and that can lead to people working from home and so on and so forth. It sounds like there's a caution here that maybe too much flexibility and too much working from remote locations might create less collisions and less of this sort of creative energy.
Yeah, certainly. I think research as well as recent history in the world of work would suggest that given the choice, mobile workers, therefore workers that are empowered to work from any location by virtue of their digital devices as well as access to digital data, actually choose to work side by side where they can, sometimes even choosing workspaces that are not the traditional office, such as co-working spaces, for example, or a whole host of other spaces that you might find in an urban context that could provide work. Certainly, that doesn't mean that every single space is optimized for work, as you can see. And I think the complexity that we see coming ahead, because that Ben was referencing, just because of the complexity of work in the years ahead, begins to give us some very specific design requirements for those kinds of work environments. But the ability to create spaces where information exchange and knowledge exchange among its occupants is possible is certainly becoming an important factor.
Sure. So, Ben, if it's all about collisions, does that mean that managers should just think about building big social spaces for their employees to, you know, to collide in, bigger common rooms and expect better results? Is it that simple?
I think certainly in some companies, there's been an emphasis on these social spaces, and I'd say the data shows that, by and large, that's a good thing. But there's really this trade-off between essentially exploration and execution. There are times when you need to come up with new ideas, and then those collisions are extremely important. Then there are also times when you need to execute something, be that a project or build a product. And then it's much more about supporting very tight-knit groups, and that requires very different things. The issue is it's very difficult to create a workspace that allows you to seamlessly change between those two things. And part of that is on us to understand what's going to make us effective. But ideally, this is something where managers, where the company, and where ourselves, where we're very attuned to what we need, and where we can put ourselves in an environment so that we can be most successful.
Listeners, we want to hear from you on this. What kind of workspace works best from you? Is it a corner cubicle, a private office, some kind of noisy common room or cafeteria? And what about co-working spaces, which we're going to talk about? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm talking to Ben Waber and Jennifer Magnolfi. They authored a piece in the Harvard Business Review about this. This is in a special edition of the Harvard Business Review called Why We Hate Our Offices and How to Build a Workspace We Can Love. So let's talk a little bit about how this works in practice. Ben, what does it look like? Tell me, you talk about a company, a Norwegian telecommunications company called Telenor that shifted its workspace in 2003 in a big way and got very positive results. And they figured out a way to increase these collisions in their office space. What did they do?
So there's a number of companies out there that are traditionally what they're doing. In the Telenor example, it's one of my co-authors, Greg Lindsay, who actually was very knowledgeable and worked with them on that. And really what they're working to do is create these common spaces and create social spaces for people to interact. And it's very interesting because traditionally in corporate real estate, what you focus on is things like utilization. Mm-hmm. You look at cost per square foot. And the idea is, how many people can I cram into an office? And that the idea is, if I can cram more people in, I'm going to save money and that's better. But you increasingly look at companies, you know, like Telenor and other organizations that say, well, we really care about productivity. I don't actually care about cost per square foot. It's difficult to measure that. And by a cost per square foot measure, creating big open common areas is extremely expensive and extremely inefficient. But companies are today making leaps of faith to say, that's what we're going to do, and that's going to increase collisions between people. And in the case of Telenor, it was wildly successful. I think increasingly you're going to see companies and people demand to see data to say, if you're going to make this change, mm-hmm. if you're Yahoo and you're going to force me to work in the office, I want to see the data showing that that's going to make me more successful. And I think that's where we need to get to, both as companies as well as a society.
You know, it's interesting in terms of the Telenor example, the CEO of Telenor that you quote in this piece says that the key sort of mind shift here is to think of the workspace as a communication tool rather than as a place where you work. I mean, of course, it's a place where you work, but the idea of workspace as a communication tool seems like sort of a jump that folks need to make here.
It's interesting. I mean, trivially, if I sit next to you, I'm very likely to talk to you.
Right.
And if we sit on different floors, I'm probably less likely to talk to you. Companies, even that very simple observation, companies don't pay attention to that to the extent that I will give you a seat where I have an open desk. And that has huge implications for how people will actually communicate at work, how we'll collaborate, which is the whole reason we work in companies, is to do something together. And it's only recently that you started to see companies say, well, I'm going to design my office space. I'm going to organize everything to create the communication patterns that I want. And in the future, you're going to say, well, let's actually have the data help tell me what actually is making me successful.
There's some really sort of nitty-gritty examples in here as well. For instance, I can't remember which company it was, but sometime we mentioned this, Sasha and I did in the introduction. Sometimes the location of the coffee machine and the number of coffee machines can even play into this, right?
That's right. And it's actually very interesting. In one company in particular, they had where we deployed our technology in their headquarters, and they had so many coffee areas. First of all, they had really terrible coffee. Because they had so many coffee machines, they were going to have to pay somebody to refill coffee if they had more than regular and decaf. But on top of that, there was one coffee area for every six people, which meant that you saw people at the coffee machine who you already knew. What they did is they said, well, they used our data to say, well, let's actually eliminate all these coffee areas and spend a lot of money, millions of dollars, to build up a big central coffee area with lots of seating and better food, better coffee. And what that did is not only change behavior, but increase their sales by over 20%, which for this company is, I mean, hundreds of millions of dollars. It's not bad. And you think about how small of a change that is, you know, how many coffee machines you have. I mean, what CEO is thinking about that? But the point is, maybe they should.
1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking about how to build a workspace, a workplace that we can all love. Let's go to Alex, who's calling from Medford. Hi, Alex.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What's on your mind?
Well, it's just funny for me talking about, you know, work environments because I'm a gardener. So I kind of create the area that I work best in. So when you show up, there's all sorts of cluttered mess, and it's really hard to see where you're going. And once you actually start work and you're starting to rip things out and you start to make this pile of mess, then you really start to get a feel for what's under there. And it just, like, you know, is really opening. You get to dig everything out, lay it on the line, and pick and choose what you're putting back in. And it's just a really great work environment for me personally. And, you know, I just love every day getting out there and feeling good about where I'm working. And
Alex, I'm glad you called in. I mean, we're sort of talking about design of office spaces, but it's nice to get that perspective from the great outdoors. And obviously, you're enthusiastic about your work environment. But Ben, you know, just listening to Alex sort of talking about, I mean, this just raises the question, because in a way, we're talking about using data to design a workspace that is the most efficient and the most productive. But here's Alex talking about a work environment that he loves, you know, and is there a way to measure that, and how important is that?
It's difficult to measure that. Obviously, if we at the point where we can measure that, maybe we don't need people so much to actually work. I think what's interesting about, you know, what Alex was talking about is this idea that he was making his workspace his own.
Yeah.
And that a lot of us want to be able to do that, but it's very hard to do that. And I think at the same time, there's a difference between focusing on ourselves and focusing on the people that we work with. I would argue that most companies shouldn't care about what an individual produces. A lot of us like to think I'm productive when I make a big report or answer a lot of email. But imagine if you can affect 20 people you work with and make them 10% more effective. Well, that should be your job.
I see.
The issue is that it's been very difficult to measure that, and that when you
rather than just measuring what you're
putting out.
There.
It's very easy to measure your output.
Gotcha.
And I think that when you talk about you creating your own workspace, you also want to think about how do you affect other people. And in Alex's case, it's just him. But I think when you have many people together, that's the part that's really hard to navigate.
Yeah. Jennifer, I'd love to get you to explain what co-working spaces are. You write about this in this piece with Ben. Really interesting idea and very effective along the lines that we're talking about here. What's a co-working space?
Well, actually, in hearing Alex's point, I was actually reminded of the ideas that certainly were at the start of this movement, which is now a very large global movement of both co-workers as well as co-working spaces. The term co-working refers to a specific work style and also a specific type of workspace. From a very practical perspective, we understand the traditional office as being a work environment where many different people, usually employees, who work for the same company share physical environment. In a co-working space, instead, you would have many different companies, ranging from an individual freelancer, small businesses, startups, in some cases large corporate teams, all sharing the same space together as part of a work community. So it's kind of an upside-down design logic. As a space, it's designed not to maximize efficiencies, for example, as Ben was mentioning earlier, which has been the traditional dominating paradigm in corporate real estate context, but it's a space designed to maximize learning. And the way co-working spaces, their community managers as well as their community members do it, is by three design management principles, you know, openness, sharing, and co-creation. This is how I've identified them in my work. So these are environments that by definition are places designed to be open, both in the design of the physical space as well as in the general attitudes of members of the space, to be open to be inspired and inspire others. There are very much about sharing resources, in some cases the space itself, but also, for example, conference rooms or high-end equipment such as video conferencing equipment or printing, for example, or 3D printers even. And they really create this context of co-creation, which is beyond collaboration. It's actually a byproduct of collisions, which is a term that we use in the article quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the idea that if you create a space that, in a sense, mimics or echoes the types of interactions that we are used to having in digital space today. So think about Twitter, an environment, a digital space, a platform that is designed by definition to heighten your exposure to new information that comes from many different sources that you don't even know. A co-working space is designed in a similar way. It's an environment that's designed to maximize the probability of collisions between occupants.
But here's the thing that I'm confused about, about this idea of co-working space, is you've got a whole bunch of people, but not necessarily working toward the same ends, right?
That is correct, actually.
Yeah, right.
So there is an aspect of that that is very different than a traditional office, where the same goal and the same end might be a corporate vision, for example. In the case of a co-working space, the common, affinity factor begins to be the culture of the space that eventually emerges and certainly is curated by a community manager over time.
Sure. Well, let me try to get one more call in here. Lisa is calling from Brookline. Hi, Lisa. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling because I'm a doctor of chiropractic, and I wanted to point out that one of the trends in the chiropractic community is that many offices have begun to be open offices, so that many folks are waiting to be adjusted. The doctor is working over on one side, but there's a real chance for cross-pollination between all the patients to talk and to learn from each other and from each other's experiences.
Interesting. And what about between the doctors? Do you find you're learning from each other as doctors as well? I mean,
if
as chiropractors?
Doctor in the practice, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, Lisa, thanks so much. Ben, that sounds like a great real-life description of collision happening.
That's right. And if you thought about it again from a pure real estate perspective, I don't want to have that open space because I want to try to get, you know, as many customers
sure.
as I can, as many patients as I can, in this case, you know, into the same space. And this right now, a lot of companies and even small businesses are taking it on faith that this is important. And I think it's the struggle that both, you know, whether it's landlords as well as developers and companies are trying to figure out where really how important is this and what is the trade-off? And clearly, if I have square, you know, acres worth of space for a single individual, that's too much. But trying to create something that's a little bit, you know, a little bit cozy, but can create just some of those interactions and still let people get some work done is very powerful.
So, Ben, sort of final thought before we say goodbye. You know, we talked about the fads over the years. So as you look around at the typical workspace that might be stuck in one of these fads, what's the biggest flaw that you find in sort of office design? What do businesses typically get wrong out there these days?
A big thing today, and Jennifer can also speak a lot to this, is just the idea that, well, you don't need to have your own desk. So what we're going to try to do is get people to share desks. Mm. And it seems like actually a really nice idea, because what it means is you can sit wherever you want, and then that'll enable you to very organically work with other people. But it causes some problems, particularly when you look at trying to actually execute on something, where all of a sudden I don't know where to find you.
Yeah.
I don't know how we can collaborate tightly, and that's very difficult for these workplaces to support.
Well, really interesting. A lot of interesting stuff to think about. That's Ben Waber. He's the president and CEO of Sociometric Solutions, and he's a visiting scientist at the MIT Media Lab. And Jennifer Magnolfi, R&D consultant who focuses on high-tech work environments. You can find a link to their recent piece in the Harvard Business Review, Workspaces That Move People. Ben, Jennifer, thank you both very much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And listeners, stay with us. Coming up, a Boston priest's reaction to the Catholic Church, softening its language on same-sex unions and couples living together outside of marriage. I'm Anthony Brooks with Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Radio Boston.